Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Join me, please. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Homage to the Buddha, the blessed, noble, and fully self-awakened one. So I'd say this is really for, aimed at beginners or false beginners, people who began, gave up for a while, and have returned to the fold. So there's three things we have to be clear about. First of all is, what does the Buddha mean by right awareness? Secondly, how do we deal with these mental states that keep dragging us away from our attention, keep dragging the attention away? And the third thing is to be very clear what it is we're actually trying to investigate, because if we don't know what we're investigating, it's going to be a waste of time. So the first thing is right awareness, and I my normal way of explaining this is to just run through very quickly the Buddha's own experience. So remember, he left his family because of what we would call an existential crisis. He was concerned with his with sickness, aging, and death, and this drove him to try and find an answer to it. And the first people he goes to are people who teach him how to develop ecstatic states, which you'll find in all religions through prayer, mantra, etc. And he became very proficient at these. They invited him to become a teacher. But to his disappointment, when they disappeared, he found himself to be depressed and anxious and still stuck in his existential crisis. So he tried something else, which was self-mortification, which was a practice of the times, based on the idea that the body was itself a manifestation of karma, and that the soul was trapped in the body, and that if one could let go of the body, which meant it's the pleasures and joys of the body, because it was the pleasures and joys of the body that were keeping the soul rooted in this particular existence. Once the body had been let go of, the soul would naturally rise to heaven. So the great teacher of that was the Jain leader, the Nigantha. And in the Jain religion, you'll find that elderly people will just stop eating, just let go of the body, and it's considered to be the right thing to do. Well, the Buddha tried this. He tried the self-mortification exercise. He said he could hold his spine through his stomach. He got so thin. So if you try that, you'll see how thin he was. And he again just found it to be more suffering. So he abandoned that. And so now he's really experienced everything that the religious scene could offer him. And so we can only imagine that he was on the road there feeling quite dejected, when along comes a woman, we seem to have her name, Sujata, which means auspicious birth, with a little sweetmeat for the local god. And seeing this poor wretch, she decides to offer it to him. Of course, in the scriptures it said he was glowing like a god and she was drawn to him, but I can't imagine that. So, putting that little aside, the thing is that he eats this and, of course, it revives him. And somewhere around that time, he has the memory of being a child watching his father doing a ploughing ceremony. And he remembers being as concentrated, as focused as any of the other stuff that he's learned, with a sort of an added ingredient, which was this inquiry, this curiosity, like, what is my daddy doing? Why is he doing what he's doing? And this seems to have turned his practice completely on its head. So instead of searching for happiness, he now wants to know how he creates the suffering. And it's with this sort of inspiration that he sits under the fig tree. And he made a determination to either to crack this problem or die. So I always say, lucky for him, lucky for us. 6 hours on, and he's cracked it. We call that the Bodhi tree, because the religious Bodhi tree, the religious fig tree, because he became enlightened underneath one. So from then on, of course, he gets up from that posture and begins to teach. So now, just going back on that, just going back to the child, you'll see that when a child sees something that they haven't seen before, a beetle or something, how they become, their eyes lock onto it and the world disappears. They're completely involved in watching this little creature. And the jaw drops. Huh? So to us, they look absolutely gormless. Yeah? See, and you think, well, they're not there, so you give them a clip on the back of the head and tell them and they wake up. And of course, destroying their ability to become fully liberated. And somehow that tells us of this awareness. So the attention is driven, riven into what you're observing, and there's no thinking, because that's what the jaw, the relaxed jaw, is telling us. Sometimes when you meditate, you can sometimes feel these little tremblings and fibrillations just on the tongue as the thoughts come. So the jaw, the tongue are, of course, intimately connected with thinking. So that relaxed jaw, the fact that the child goes gormless and completely relaxed, is telling us that they're not thinking. They're just receiving, just receiving. Now, that gives us an idea of what this awareness is, this right awareness. But that's, as it were, our entrance, if we can keep an image of that child, right? Just observing, yeah, not thinking. Now, there are things that take us away from that, of course, which we call the hindrances. Now, they're only hindrances in the sense that they when we give into them, or just by habit, we find ourselves being taken away from our practice. But in fact, they're our teachers. So there are two types. There's those types that just draw us away. So there's all those things about desire, planning a holiday and stuff like that, the mind's off, you see. There's all the stuff around aversion. You find yourself being angry with somebody and throttling them, you see. There's all that stuff around guilt, shame, general restlessness, both in the body and in the mind, when it just won't stop thinking. And there's doubt. So doubt, pernicious doubt, or skeptical doubt, is the doubt that stops you doing something. It's based on fear of consequence, fear of failure, some sort of fear. So you can't be suffering from that when it comes to vipassana, because you're all here practicing vipassana. But obviously, if you find doubt is coming up about, I can, you know, everybody else can do it. You look around, everybody's sat like statues, and you're fiddling, and you think, well, I can't do it. So this is self-doubt. So you know doubt. You don't get caught up in what the mind is telling you. You're always stepping back from what the mind is telling you. So the technique there, just as a general technique, is that as soon as the mind wanders, you come off that thinking mind, the wandering mind, and as you come in, and you recognize, you actually acknowledge that attitude or mood, emotion that's driving it. See? So you're planning a holiday, and when you come off that, you find yourself excited. So it's an exciting sort of mental state that's being developed. If you find yourself worrying when you come in, you can sometimes feel the anxiety. So when that happens, you come, and that's your object. The anxiety, the feeling of excitement, the joy, whatever it is. Even when it's beautiful, you do the same. So you might be in a state of loving compassion, you know, saving the world. And as you come in, you just feel that state. You don't do anything. You just let it arise and pass away. Now, it's the same technique no matter what is drawing your mind away. See, now the important thing is you're not trying to seek origins. You're not trying to find out why it's there. Right? You're not trying to find out why it's there. All you want is the consequence of past actions. That's what we're interested in. We're not interested in why it's come to be like this. Because the consequence itself holds the whole of the past. What we're experiencing is the full consequence of past action. When this goes, the past action is irrelevant. It's gone. Okay? I'll come to that during the question and answer bit. So, remember, mind wanders, you wake up, you recognize, you acknowledge where it is, you come into the body and you feel it. If you can't feel anything, you just go back to the breath. Very simple. If you can, wait until it passes. Often, just as it's passing, we put the mind on something else, or we lose attention to it. But what we really want to do is to feel the end of that excitement, the end of that anxiety, and just see what happens after it, you see? Just that sense of relief, the release from it, you see? That's a little touch of nibbana, small end, right? That's a touch of it. Sometimes you'll see it transform. So what was anger, suddenly you find it transforming quite naturally into some form of love. So these things happen just naturally, or you can't, if you try to manufacture that, then you're not doing vipassana, okay? Because what we're interested in is process, what we're interested in is our relationship to what we're actually experiencing. The opposite of that, of course, is dullness and lethargy, right? Where we just zonk out one way or the other. So it can be these heavy feelings in the head, and a dullness, or it can be the heavy feelings in the body. So these things are to be taken as seriously as anxiety and depression. They are, in fact, a mental illness. They're a sickness within the mind. And we tend to think, oh, they're nothing. But actually, they're suppressive measures that we've used to keep things out of our consciousness. And often, when we allow them to come up and disappear, the underlying mental state that we've hidden from ourselves often arises. But that's not our purpose. Our purpose is not to be caught up in the dullness and lethargy, because every time we allow ourselves to go into it, you see, even as a habit, we're actually developing it. And that's one of the problems of the wandering mind. Whether we like it or not, as soon as the mind starts thinking, it's actually generating more of that emotion, whether you like it or not. Okay, so when we feel dullness and lethargy, if it's in the head or the body, keep the attention moving. Because every time you move the attention, as it were, you wake yourself up. But you're feeling it. You know? You're exploring the sensations of dullness and lethargy. That's all. That's all you have to do. You're allowing, in all this process, you're allowing the heart to express itself, right? And that's the process of healing. You don't have to do anything. So that's the part that we're at. 99% of our practice is dealing with these unwholesome mental states. Right? To do that would, of course, to make that the purpose would be to miss the point. The point is now to actually see these three characteristics, because in seeing these three characteristics of existence, we're actually beginning to understand where the real problem lies. Okay? The first one is this process of desire. So it's a special type of desire. It's not good desire. The desire to come and meditate is to be developed. But it's those desires where we are seeking happiness in the sensual world which causes an attachment. What we mean by an attachment is a psychological dependency on something for a particular mental state that I describe as happiness. It's as simple as that. And it's dependent on something. So as soon as that which disappears, then I get all the consequences. The grief of loss, fear of loss anyway, frustration when I don't get what I want. All that is because of this wrong attachment to things. And its manifestation is the desire. The desire. Yeah. So when we see something pleasant in the body and heart, when we see that, you've got to catch that movement towards it to try and maintain, to try and develop it. And just feel that sense of desire. As the desire passes away, you see, then you form a relationship with what you're experiencing, which is this equanimity, right? And in that equanimity, you can explore the original mental state. Okay? So that's what this desire is to be separated clearly from the object it desires. Right? Now that's quite difficult to do because they're very close. Yeah? Soon as something comes up in the heart which begins to manifest as a nice little holiday, and then to come back to the original excitement and its desire, and then you see that energy that wants to go back into the mind, back into the dream, and to stay there with that energy. See? And wait for it to dissipate, wait for it to go away. And then to try and stay to the very end of it to see what happens when it disappears. What's the mental state arises when it's not being disturbed by these desires. And then, of course, there's the aversion. So aversion is, of course, pushing stuff away. And it's again, now that's easier to do because the aversion obviously separates itself from what it's averse to. So to catch the sense of aversion, the sense of anxiety about something that's happening within us is an easier task. But you've got to stay with it. You've got to actually feel it, that process of turning away, pushing away. And you wait until it completely dissipates, all right? And then you find this new relationship of equanimity, patience, with something which is unpleasant, okay? And what we're discovering is, what's the distinction between pain and suffering, right? Is there a distinction to be made? And we're trying to make a distinction between enjoying something and indulging it. See? Can we eat our cake and not indulge? Very difficult. So these are explorations for us, right? Both inwardly and, of course, in daily life. So we can talk about that too at the end. The second thing is impermanence. Now, obviously, I mean, you went up to somebody in the street and said everything changes. They said, yeah, so what? I mean, that's not the problem. The problem is this constant feeling within us of there being somebody that is absolutely always there experiencing something. Right? That sense of self. So it's actually staying with something and really staying until the end. That's the first thing. You'll notice that when something new comes up, even when it's pleasant or unpleasant, you're right on it. See, the arising of something, we've taught ourselves to be right there with it. As it moves towards the end, we take the attention somewhere else. Especially when it's something pleasant. When we see something pleasant at the end, the mind's already getting bored. It wants to find something else to look at. Okay? So we're never catching the end of things. Now, when we start catching the end of things, we're catching many deaths, right? We're catching many deaths. And it's coming to term with the fact that everything actually dies. It annihilates. It completely disappears, you see. And then you begin to realize that the knowing, that which knows the mind, that which actually is observing the mind, the consciousness that arises with it must also be arising and passing away with its object. And that's the core of the practice. So it's trying to really stay with the ending of things, right? And in daily life too, see? End of a day, dies with sleep. See? So it's drumming ourselves to that point. Now, of course, it is preparing ourselves for the big takeoff at the at the end of life so that, you know, things come to an end, you see? Brings up a bit of fear, that's great. Feel the fear. Do it anyway. You've read the book, yeah? The third one is the doctrine of anatta. Now, the Buddha never said there was no self. That would be ridiculous because everybody experiences a self. What he's saying is the self is not real, that's all. It doesn't have any substance. And two ways of beginning to explore that is everything you're looking at is an object, right? To make that very clear to yourself. So when you feel a pain in the knee's down there somewhere. And there's something up here that knows it. That separation, that distance, you see, is telling you it can't be what knows. So you're constantly making things an object. And as I say, this noting technique makes it very clear to you because you say pain, pain. Pain's over there. Something up here knows it. So that separation of the observer from the observed, the feeler from the felt, the perceiver from the perceived, right, is the process of untangling this idea of who I am. Now, when you get right back to being the observer, see, you might think, oh, well, that's it. I am the observer. I am the feeler. I am the perceiver. But unfortunately, you're aware of that. Huh? You're aware of being the observer. Right, so you can't be that either. It's a big problem, right? So we're also exploring this whole business of something that knows and what it knows and to slowly separate it out. The other side of that, which the Buddha points to, is, of course, control. Now, one of the reasons I know I'm not you is because I can't control you. Right? When I look inward, I find that I don't have this control over my mind I thought I had. Before I came to meditate, well, I thought when I wanted to think. But then when I come to meditate and I want to stop the thinking, I find it actually just keeps thinking. I thought that I was in charge of my emotions, but I suddenly find that the heart emotes whether I want it to or not. And then when I look back into my daily life, I don't say to myself in the evening, well, tomorrow I'm going to wake up depressed. I find myself waking up depressed or happy or whatever. So there's this whole business of control. Now, if the center of control is outside me, it can't be me. And that's how I... You see, if the center of control was me, I'd be able to say to myself, from now on, I'm going to be happy. And that'd be it. I'd have made it. But I can't. So there's some dislocation in our thinking about who we are when it comes to control. And in your meditation, you begin to realize that these thoughts are just happening whether you want them to or not. The body's offering us sensations all the time. And the heart offers its moods and emotions, whether we want it to or not. So it's getting into the idea that there must be, the center of control isn't out there within the psychophysical organism. How can it be me? Yeah. It's the same as a driver in a car. Of course, they can sit there, they can move it this way and that way, they can make it go faster and slower, but when the tire bursts, that's the end of it. See? So their actual control of the car is superficial. So it's the same with us in this body. So we have the idea that it must be the body because I can make it run, I can make it jump. But obviously I can't stop it growing old, can't stop it falling sick, and I can't stop it dying, which are the three main things that I really, really, really would like to control. So you can see that this whole business of control is something that also has to be investigated. So these are your three characteristics, right? The three characteristics of existence. This process of desire, which is pointing to a wrong relationship to the sensual world, the world that we're experiencing. So the fact that everything's arising and passing away. And this idea of self, something substantial, is being undermined by beginning to distinguish the knowing from what is known. And the idea of control. So this is it. Now, that's taking us to an insight, and I'll talk about that again at the end of the day. To the insight of something in us which actually doesn't belong to this psychophysical world. That's what he's drawing us towards. So here we have, first of all, instructions by the Buddha on how to observe. So that's this right awareness, the vipassana. Passana just means to see, passati. Vi just means to see clearly. So it's a way of looking, right? And if we have that image, we begin with the image of a child, that open-hearted, open-minded, clear, that interest, that real curiosity has to be there, yeah? And then we work with what is being offered us and seeing it from one of these three characteristics, right? Now, this doesn't have to be a self-reflective process. You have to have the faith. You have to have the confidence that this intuitive awareness, once it's been instructed, doesn't need to be you don't have to keep telling it. So once it knows these three characteristics, all it needs to do is just watch, just observe, just feel. And slowly the insights arise. They're small insights. It's a gradual process. Yeah? Any questions, criticisms, observations? I can only hope my words have been of some assistance, that they have not caused even greater confusion, and that by your devotion to practice, you may be liberated from suffering sooner rather than later. So if you'd like to take just a little break, what time are we waiting for? 5:12, okay. Oh, that's good. If we do just a short, say, 20 minutes, just to stretch the legs a bit, walking meditation, and then we'll come back and sit just before 1:00.